File 35.
At last, after many years of blindness, the people saw clearly into the future. Therefore, almost immediately after the gigantic struggle had begun, an excessive enthusiasm was replaced by a more earnest and more fitting undertone, because the exaltation of the popular spirit was not a mere passing frenzy. It was only too necessary that the gravity of the situation should be recognized. At that time, there was, generally speaking, not the slightest presentiment or conception of how long the war might last. People dreamed of the soldiers being home by Christmas, and that then they would resume their daily work in peace. Whatever mankind desires, that it will hope for and believe in. The overwhelming majority of the people had long since grown weary of the perpetual insecurity and the general condition of public affairs. Hence, it was only natural that no one believed that the Austro-Serbian conflict could be shelved. Therefore, they looked forward to a radical settlement of accounts. I also belong to the millions that desired this. The moment the news of the Sarajevo outrage reached Munich, two ideas came into my mind. First, that war was absolutely inevitable, and second, that the Habsburg state would now be forced to honour its signature to the alliance. For what I had feared most was that one day Germany herself, perhaps as a result of the alliance, would become involved in a conflict the first direct cause of which did not affect Austria. In such a contingency, I feared that the Austrian state, for domestic political reasons, would find itself unable to decide in favour of its ally. But now this danger was removed. The old state was compelled to fight, whether it wished to do so or not. My own attitude towards the conflict was equally simple and clear. I believed that it was not a case of Austria fighting to get satisfaction from Serbia, but rather a case of Germany fighting for her own existence. The German nation for its own to be or not to be, for its freedom and for its future. The work of Bismarck must now be carried on. Young Germany must show itself worthy of the blood shed by our fathers on so many heroic fields of battle. From Weissenburg to Sedan and Paris. And if this struggle should bring us victory, our people will again rank foremost among the great nations. Only then could the German Empire assert itself as the mighty champion of peace, without the necessity of restricting the daily bread of its children for the sake of maintaining the peace. As a boy, and as a young man, I often longed for the occasion to prove that my national enthusiasm was not mere vaporing. Hurrahing sometimes seemed to me to be a kind of sinful indulgence, though I could not give any justification for that feeling. For, after all, who has the right to shout that triumphant word if he has not won the right to it there where there is no play-acting, and where the hand of the goddess of destiny puts the truth and sincerity of nations and men through her inexorable test. Just as millions of others, I felt a proud joy in being permitted to go through this test. I had so often sung Deutschland über alles, and so often roared Heil, that now I thought it was a kind of retroactive grace that I was granted the right of appearing before the court of eternal justice, to testify to the truth of those sentiments. One thing was clear to me from the very beginning, namely, that in the event of war, which now seemed inevitable, my books would have to be thrown aside forthwith. I also realized that my place would have to be there where the inner voice of conscience called me. I had left Austria principally for political reasons. What, therefore, could be more rational than that I should put into practice the logical consequences of my political opinions now that the war had begun? I had no desire to fight for the Habsburg cause, but I was prepared to die at any time for my own kinsfolk and the empire to which they really belonged. On August the 3rd, 1914, I presented an urgent petition to His Majesty King Ludwig III, requesting to be allowed to serve in a Bavarian regiment. In those days, the Chancellery had its hands quite full, and therefore I was all the more pleased when I received the answer a day later that my request had been granted. I opened the document with trembling hands, and no words of mine could now describe the satisfaction I felt on reading that I was instructed to report to a Bavarian regiment. Within a few days, I was wearing that uniform which I was not to put off again for nearly 6 years. For me, as for every German, the most memorable period of my life now began. Face to face with that mighty struggle, all the past fell away into oblivion. With a wistful pride I look back on those days, especially because we are now approaching the 10th anniversary of that memorable happening. I recall those early weeks of war, when kind fortune permitted me to take my place in that heroic struggle among the nations. As the scene unfolds itself before my mind, it seems only like yesterday. I see myself among my young comrades on our first parade drill, and so on until at last the day came on which we were to leave for the front. In common with the others, I had one worry during those days. This was a fear that we might arrive too late for the fighting at the front. Time and again that thought disturbed me, and every announcement of a victorious engagement left a bitter taste, which increased as the news of further victories arrived. At long last, the day came when we left Munich on war service. For the first time in my life, I saw the Rhine, as we journeyed westwards to stand guard before that historic German river against its traditional and grasping enemy. As the first soft rays of the morning sun broke through the light mist and disclosed to us the Niederwald statue, with one accord the whole troop train broke into the strains of Die Wacht am Rhein. I then felt as if my heart could not contain its spirit. And then followed a damp, cold night in Flanders. We marched in silence throughout the night, and as the morning sun came through the mist, an iron greeting suddenly burst above our heads. Shrapnel exploded in our midst and spluttered in the damp ground. But before the smoke of the explosion disappeared, a wild hurrah was shouted from 200 throats in response to this first greeting of death. Then began the whistling of the bullets, and the booming of cannons, the shouting and singing of the combatants. With eyes straining feverishly, we pressed forward quicker and quicker, until we finally came to close-quarter fighting, there beyond the beet fields and the meadows. Soon the strains of a song reached us from afar. Nearer and nearer, from company to company, it came. And while death began to make havoc in our ranks, we passed the song on to those beside us. Deutschland! Deutschland über alles in der Welt! After 4 days in the trenches, we came back. Even our step was no longer what it had been. Boys of 17 looked now like grown men. The rank and file of the least regiment had not been properly trained in the art of warfare, but they knew how to die like old soldiers. That was the beginning, and thus we carried on from year to year. A feeling of horror replaced the romantic fighting spirit. Enthusiasm cooled down gradually, and exuberant spirits were quelled by the fear of the ever-present death. A time came when there arose within each one of us a conflict between the urge to self-preservation and the call of duty, and I had to go through that conflict too. As death sought its prey everywhere and unrelentingly, a nameless something rebelled within the weak body and tried to introduce itself under the name of common sense. But in reality it was fear which had taken on this cloak in order to impose itself on the individual. But the more the voice which advised prudence increased its efforts, and the more clear and persuasive became its appeal, resistance became all the stronger, until finally the internal strife was over and the call of duty was triumphant. Already in the winter of 1915 to 1916, I had come through that inner struggle. The will had asserted its incontestable mastery, whereas in the early days I went into the fight with a cheer and a laugh, I was now habitually calm and resolute. And that frame of mind endured. Fate might now put me through the final test without my nerves or reason giving way. The young volunteer had become an old soldier. This same transformation took place throughout the whole army. Constant fighting had aged and toughened it, and hardened it, so that it stood firm and dauntless against every assault. Only now was it possible to judge that army. After 2 and 3 years of continuous fighting, having been thrown into one battle after another, standing up stoutly against superior numbers and superior armament, suffering hunger and privation, the time had come when one could assess the value of that singular fighting force. For 1,000 years to come, nobody will dare to speak of heroism without recalling the German army of the World War. And then, from the dim past, will emerge the immortal vision of those solid ranks of steel helmets that never flinched and never faltered. And as long as Germans live, they will be proud to remember that these men were the sons of their forefathers. I was then a soldier, and did not wish to meddle in politics, all the more so because the time was inopportune. I still believe that the most modest stable boy of those days served his country better than the best of, let us say, the parliamentary deputies. My hatred for those footlers was never greater than in those days when all decent men who had anything to say said it point blank in the enemy's face, or, failing this, kept their mouths shut and did their duty elsewhere. I despised those political fellows, and if I had had my way, I would have formed them into a labour battalion and given them the opportunity of babbling amongst themselves to their heart's content, without offence or harm to decent people.